This is Digging in the Dirt with Kevin Gallagher, where Kevin and his guests dig a little deeper into today's issues surrounding the environment, farming, gardening, and food.
My guest this afternoon is Denise Baden, a professor of sustainable business with Southampton Business School at the University of Southampton in Britain. Denise set up the Green Stories Project, which includes free writing competitions that encourage storytellers to embed climate solutions into their stories aimed at mainstream readers across a variety of formats. She believes that solution-focused stories were more likely to inspire pro-environmental behavior. Hence, she wrote a book called Habitat Man, described as a romantic comedy with a hint of cozy mystery, which weaves in entertaining and educational green solutions such as wildlife gardening, seasonal food, and natural burials. Professor Baden is also on the Forbes list of climate leaders. I brought the professor here today on Digging in the Dirt because of an article I found on the site The Conversation entitled Five Fiction Books to Inspire Climate Action. Welcome, Ms. Baden.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. So I think a couple of reviews I read might be a good way to start. Habitat Man is a fresh approach to the present climate crisis and a must read for those who want to make a difference and create a healthier, more robust environment. It starts at home in our own garden. Another review said this was an easy read, funny, romantic story about a man who happens to love our natural world. It's packed full of small ideas anyone can do in order to make a change and contribute towards a healthier world. So, Ms. Baden, not only do you teach about these concepts, you encourage others and you yourself insinuate them into ordinary stories like you did in Habitat Man, that people can get an idea of a lifestyle that is earth and ecologically friendly. How did you come to the conclusion that doing this kind of technique actually works?
Well, partly because I teach sustainability all day long at the university and I research. The last thing I want to do, I suppose, is engage in that kind of thing in my fiction and in my stories. But at the same time, when I'm watching TV shows or reading books and it's kind of shopping and mindless consumption, it does kind of wind me up because we might all watch, you know, these heartbreaking documentaries of, you know, dead baby whales full of plastic or floods or fires. But we don't necessarily join the dots to our own behavior. So I wanted to find a way to engage those who perhaps would never watch a climate change documentary, people who just like to read genre fiction or read books just for a good time, to try and engage in the things we can do in our own backyard. Because also it's very easy to feel helpless in the face of the challenges we face. But there's plenty we can do in our own orbits, just in the choices we make. So I wanted to find a way to get that over in a way that wasn't preachy, that was good fun, that was entertaining, but also educational. So that's what the Habitat Man was all about.
So have you noticed the authors picking up on what you're saying and incorporating this idea into their stories?
Not much. One of the reasons I set up the Green Stories Project is it seemed to me that pretty well all fiction that dealt with environmental issues was catastrophic. And I'm a psychologist by background. And what I know is that when you make people fearful, it doesn't necessarily have the kind of consequences you'd hope for. You might think if I scare people about climate change and let them know how terrible things will be if we don't do something, then everyone will give up flying and eating beef and so on. But it's much more likely we'll sort of buy up all the toilet rolls, get a gun, you know, self-protective behaviours, or just go into massive sort of despair or anxiety. And I've done quite a lot of research in this field where I've exposed people to solution-focused stories with the climate element and catastrophe-focused stories. And I found that while the catastrophic stories did raise awareness, it did lead to denial or avoidance or guilt or fear or a kind of passive despair, like something should be done. Whereas when the stories had a solution, especially ones that, you know, readers could identify with, it was much more likely to lead to active intentions to change their behavior. So I thought, my word, I think we're doing this all wrong. And there's very little in the space of anything that related to the environment or climate that showed us what we could do instead. And that also moved beyond preaching to the choir. So I thought, well, that's going to be the space I'm going to carve out. And I set up the Green Stories Project to encourage writers to write into that space, gave them lots of solutions on the website, because not everyone, you know, knows about it, to be honest, even while they might be a very good writer. But I found still most entrants into the competition would focus on the problem, or they wouldn't really engage with solutions that were useful. So, for example, I got a lot of stories about people chucking in their job and going off to fight evil rainforest loggers. But first thing is, like, logging rainforests, quite often those who do it, mainly in Indonesia, sometimes they're little more than bonded slaves. It's not like they're choosing to do that. It's a systemic issue. And also, you know, your reader's not really likely to do that. Whereas Habitat Man, for example, he digs up a body. That's a nice excuse to have a burial scene, a natural burial rather than hardwood. So you can see that's actually much more effective behavior change, is to focus on the demand side. Well, let's reduce the demand for wood. I promote seasonal vegetables. So eating less beef, more seasonal vegetables will again reduce the demand to have these rainforests cleared. So most, I guess a lot of the people were still not adopting that solution-based approach. And I thought, well, if you can't find the book you want, because I was really looking for a book to signpost, you know, competition entrants to as an example, and there I could barely find any. So that was one of the motivations to write Habitat Man.
I get it. You had to do it yourself to show everybody what you're talking
about. That's
right. Well, it's pretty cool. I mean, I'm going through it, and it's so, like you said, I'm just reading along, and all of a sudden we're talking about compost, you know, or like one thing stuck out to me is that they were talking in the book. I don't sure who the characters were, but they said, don't think what we won't do, think what we can do. It's tricky. Habitats work best when you stop doing stuff, leave Mother Nature alone, which I totally believe, but you know, you don't see it in a book very often.
No, that's right. So I'm a fairly lazy gardener. So I took to wildlife gardening in an instant. It was actually inspired by a real life green garden consultant who'd given up his job to take early retirement, and he wanted to make gardens wildlife friendly. And he had a degree in biology that he hadn't really used much. And he came over and advised me on my garden, and he helped me put up a water butt and a bat box. He chopped down my bamboo, which might be very good in its native Asia, but isn't so great in the UK.
I don't like bamboo.
Or the US. he suggested that I don't need to take all my garden debris down the dump. I can create a false back to my garden with a nice hedge, which provides a nice habitat for birds, food for insects, and behind it I can then dump all my garden debris, and hedgehogs will like that, and slow worms, and a pond, and pollinator friendly plants, and so on. Let my grass grow a bit longer. And he said to me, I wish I could do the whole world, but there's only so many gardens I could do. And I was looking for a project then. I'd sort of started another novel, but suddenly I thought, this is great. I actually thought of it as a TV series at first. I thought, yep, you've got a different garden each week, but you've got the same locations. Throw in a romance, throw in a mystery, and you have a really nice story. So that was my lockdown project. I'm always ashamed to say I had a lovely lockdown. We had the best spring ever in the UK at that time, and my real life Habitat Man had opened my eyes to nature. So I saw my garden in a whole new way. It was like seeing the world in black and white, and he brought it to colour for me, because suddenly I saw it from the perspective of birds or bees or worms. And I'd never really seen it that way before. And what my aim was to try and do the same for my readers, is to let them see the garden from the perspective of nature. It's not your garden to sort of throw pesticides at and do this and do that and plant plants that don't really fit there and get annoyed if they don't work. It's actually, it's nature's garden. It's there for the creatures that live there. Yeah. And it was a lovely way to see it. So
It
I
sounds like
gained a lot from writing it as well.
it sounds great. It sounds like you had a similar experience my wife and I had with our backyard. It's sort of, you sound like you, as we have, a secret garden, you know, where you could hang out in that garden and pass the, as you say, the lockdown during that COVID period. But it definitely gave us an appreciation for our yard too. We try to do a lot what you say.
Yes, and we lost, there weren't so many aeroplanes flying over, the cars had stopped, and suddenly you could hear the birds. So it was kind of a magical time to sort of alternate writing and sitting out in the garden for inspiration.
So is your premise that you think these positive climate access stories work to change minds? And if so, do you see any hint that it could be leak into other medium, you know, like the detective story or the police procedural on TV? Do you see any of that happening at all, or is this still infant stage of this idea?
Kevin, it's funny you should ask that because the BBC and Netflix and Hollywood in general, they are looking to find ways to address this through the TV shows and the films they put on. And the Hollywood Climate Summit set up a Writing Climate Pitch Fest last year to encourage writers to embed green solutions in their stories. And three productions apparently are underway as a result of that. And I am so excited. Next week, I entered this year with a TV series, a sort of family drama stroke political legal thriller called The Assassin. And I made it all the way through to one of the winners who will be pitching to four Hollywood executives next
Very
week.
cool. That's great.
So I'm very
Congratulations.
excited
Hope,
about
yeah,
that.
let's hope you get it.
I hope so too, but I've got to try and break down 3 seasons worth of plot into a 4-minute pitch.
I'm sure you can do it. You're very eloquent. So we're speaking with Denise Baden, and she's here talking about her book, The Habitat Man, and we're going to jump into something else in a moment. But you know, before we do that, recently, I came up with, and you, I think you even mentioned it in an article you wrote, the term Thrutopian. Now I'm totally understanding utopian and dystopian, but I'm not all that familiar, and I don't think my listeners are familiar with Thrutopian. Can you tell us what that's about?
Well, there's no shame in not being familiar with it because it's a very new term and it tries to find its way. I guess, yeah, utopia is literally means no land. In other words, it's imaginary, it can't ever exist. And we know what dystopia means. Thrutopia imagines a sustainable society, what it might look like if we do it right. And then sort of works backwards from there to look at what we might have to do to get there. And I like that idea because I've had a bit of a butterfly background in business, economics, politics, psychology. So I've got quite a good systemic view. And it strikes me that we talk a lot about renewable energy, for example, but do we have the right levers in place that we're going to choose those options? Do we have the right levers in place in our political system? That means we're going to make good long-term decisions. So I quite like looking at more systemic solutions because they will lead on. So if I give you an example of my Thrutopian thinking, I think I've got a good idea of what a future society would look like if we did it well, relatively equitable, powered by renewable energy. Now, are we going to get there while consumption and production is our metric of success? No. So, firstly, we have to change our metric of success to something like the well-being index or a happy planet index. And there has been quite a lot of talk about that. Are we going to make the kinds of policies that will invest in green energy, that will take away subsidies from fossil fuels, that will subsidize more renewable energy? While we have a government that is basically paid for by vested interests, that is lobbied by business, that has 4-year electoral cycles, that means it's very difficult to think long term. I think that would be quite difficult. And I'm not proposing an authoritarian government, but there's been quite a lot going on in the field of more participative approaches, such as citizens' assemblies. where it's, think of it more like a citizens' jury, where people are randomly selected to debate a particular topic, selected like to be representative in terms of gender, ethnicity, age, class, and so on, informed by experts. And we've done a lot of these in Europe and in Northern Ireland, and we've got a climate assembly where I live at the moment. The only trouble is they don't really have legislative power. They have the power to recommend. But there have been talks that our second chamber is the House of Lords, its archaic bastion of privilege. If we replace that with the House of Citizens, then we'd be supplementing our representative democracy with a more participative, representative, sort of issue-based forum. That, for me, would be a good systemic solution that might better enable more climate-friendly decisions. And again, if we look at how we spend our money, one of the things you come across all the time as you know, as individuals, you think, well, why should I give up flying and eating steak and so on if no one else is doing it? I will if everyone else does, but it won't make much difference if only I do it. But we did propose back in the UK, it's like 25 years ago, some talked about tradable energy quotas, some talked about them as personal carbon allowances, but they all focused around this idea that you have your own allocation. In a way, of carbon, and you use that up through the energy you use. And if it's renewable energy, you wouldn't use much at all, and the things you buy. And then if you go over that, you purchase it. And if you go under it, then you can sell your spare carbon credits. And that would drive investment into more sustainable products and services. It would incentivize more sustainable consumption. So these are the kinds of things that would lead to the right decisions being made and perhaps need to be in place at least one or two of those before it's likely that we will ever make a sufficiently transformative change to the way we run ourselves to address climate change, because we've left it really late. I don't have to tell you or your audience. We don't have much time to waste now, but the
Yep.
trajectory we're on is not fast enough or substantive enough to avoid those tipping points that we're also worried about. So my Thrutopian approach, and I thought, well, none of this is going to happen because politicians aren't going to talk about this because it doesn't fit nicely in a soundbite. Sometimes it goes against their own personal interests. Whereas you can cover these topics in a story. So, for example, The Assassin, which I was talking about, is based on a short story that's part of another anthology I edited, No More Fairy Tales, Stories to Save Our Planet, where eight people are in a citizens' jury debating climate solutions, and then there's a murder. So you've got the fun whodunit, but at the same time, these are the kinds of climate solutions being debated, and you see it from every different person's point of view, how they engage with that idea. So it's a lovely way to kind of seed, I mean, you know, talking gardening, prepare the ground. So that if we do start talking about these kinds of things, people might be already a little bit familiar with the idea.
Yeah, some of it sounds a bit utopian from an old cynic on the environment,
Yeah,
but
I don't think we're ready for these yet. I don't think we are. But I think at some point we might be. We might be scared enough. And ready enough to start making some of those changes. We might have to.
Right, exactly. I guess what intrigued me about your work is that I'm interested in how do we reach a larger part of the population to get them to understand the issue that concerns environmental, psychological, and climate breakdown, and I'm afraid that not enough of the world is motivated to change and certainly change fast enough to mitigate the serious problems we face. I mean, I think it's a speed and scale. So anything we can do, including what you're doing, it seems to me to be a good idea to try to win hearts and minds.
For sure. I mean, Habitat Man is very much what you can do, what individuals can do in their own backyard. The No More Fairy Tales, Stories to Save Our Planet, and that Assassin short story is much more, maybe more speculative fiction. It's like what we could do if we were going to think outside the box a bit and adopt more transformative system-wide solutions.
Right.
So it's a sort of playing with ideas more. But I think you have to be fighting on both fronts.
Yep, I agree. And speaking of fighting, I'd like to briefly touch on the Extinction Rebellion. We don't really have an organized version of this over here in the United States, but it's pretty active in the UK. What's your opinion of them? Do you think the idea of confrontational actions like they do, like throwing dye or on artwork or chaining or gluing themselves to stuff, is that a viable method, or is it turning more people off than it's converting?
Well, it's a really good question. And the fact is, Extinction Rebellion started off being quite confrontational, and they got in the news. And then they were sort of statistics out that they were putting people off with that, especially when people can't get to work because they're blocking a motorway. So then they tried to be peaceful. And a few months ago, they had this massive campaign where they protested huge crowds, thousands and thousands of crowds in London, absolutely peaceful, and the media did not touch it. It got a tiny thing in some Australian news. But I was watching, I thought, this is huge. Like, where are the news stories? But because no one, you know, got sprayed or painting or inconvenienced, they didn't bother reporting it. So I think that the media are kind of creating the situation where only if they upset people or cause damage will they get their voices heard. Because only if you were part of those, I don't know, 30-odd thousand who were out 4 days in a row, would you know it even happened. So they're caught in a no-win situation there. And what they do about it, I don't know. I'm glad I'm not on their strategy committee, because it seems to be a lose-lose. But at the same time, you have to do something.
And, you know, even the Ministry for the Future, which is one of the books you chose, has some stories about future eco-terrorism that goes even further than what we've been talking about. Maybe this is a good time to jump into the five books that you selected at the conversation. The conversation is a site that democratizes knowledge by helping academic experts to write for the public. Free to read, free to republish, no ads and no paywalls. And I've never heard of you, I never heard of some of these concepts, and fairly well read. And I really came to like this site and your article about these, environmentally friendly books, to put it in one way. So, as I mentioned, one of the books is The Ministry for the Future, but that could almost be considered utopian, dystopian, and thrutopian. You know, there's so many different stories in there.
Yeah.
Why don't we start with that? Why did you select The Ministry for the Future?
Because when I was looking for a book that kind of talked about how we might get from where we are now to where we need to be, that was about the only one I could think of. And you're right, it starts off quite dystopian. And we end up in a reasonably optimistic place, but not without some real tragedies and disasters. And what Kim Stanley Robinson does, he talks about huge, audacious engineering solutions, such as refreezing glaciers. He talks about systemic solutions, such as carbon credits and harnessing the power of finance. Like you mentioned, he talks about a dark wing where those sort of blocking progress are quietly sort of taken out. He just imagines there's a sort of ministry for the future at the heart of the United Nations. And so I think it's a great book. And
agree.
The author, Stan, as I know of him now, was kind enough to donate a couple of chapters to our No More Fairy Tales Stories to Save the Planet. So I was really pleased that he did that.
He's a good man. He's been on this program too,
I'm sure.
Yeah. So you picked five books. So why don't we go through them briefly? How about Fairhaven? Why Fairhaven?
So Fairhaven is written by Steve Willis and Jan Lee. Now, Steve Willis is a right character. He's a chemical engineer. He's British born, works in Malaysia. And he's passionate about all the engineering solutions that could help us. And desperately sad that not enough funding is going into them. I went to COP28 with him last year, and it was lovely hanging out with an engineer because I saw everything through an engineer's eyes. And he wrote a story about a young engineer who really takes on the challenge of rising sea levels in Malaysia imagines how the seawalls could be developed, imagines oil rigs to reefs projects where you take old oil rigs and then you grow seagrass and kelp. Because when we're talking about drawing down carbon, everyone thinks of trees, but trees use up precious land and they can also burn. Seagrass and kelp are probably lesser known, but probably very, very effective solutions. So he uses this story of an engineer turned celebrity, turned politician in the end, to showcase some of these solutions. So it's more like a blueprint for action. And when he first submitted what, part of the book as a short story to one of the competitions, so there's great ideas here, but sorry, but you've got to, your writing style isn't just going to cut it. So he teamed up with Jan Lee, who writes, and together we've got that climate expertise and that writing expertise, and they've put together this great story that is kind of a blueprint for action in a way.
Cool. Fairhaven by Steve Willis and Jan Lee.
Yeah, and then you're hot off the press because it's only just been published.
Great, great. Well, I'm sure people listening are going to want to know some of these, so I'm going to reiterate what we're talking about. Green Rising is another one that is by Lauren James. You call it adult fiction about teenagers with superpowers. So tell us a little bit about that.
I like that. Lauren James runs the Climate Fiction Writers League. And I was at a gig with her once for the Responsible Media Summit. And I read the story, and obviously there's not a clear link to action because we don't all have, hands that can sprout endless amounts of plant material. But
We're
we
not
kind of can.
superpowers.
We kind of got garden and plant and so on. So we can in different ways. And her sort of villain is a character who really is diverting all the resources that should be going in to save our planet into this off-world Martian dream, which, is A, completely unfeasible, and B, is only going to benefit the rich and leave the rest of us burning. And I liked that because I think, I mean, I used to watch Star Trek. I understand the dream, but I think she raises a valid concern that, the wealth and the innovation of some of the smartest and richest people is perhaps being misdirected when there's a much more, let's save our beautiful planet that we have evolved
Yeah,
to
instead of
flourish.
going to Mars, right?
Yeah, rather than this horrible place with no air and no good soil and
Yeah, I
so
mean
on.
it's ludicrous. Watch The Expanse and you'll see that it's really rough living out in outer space. It's not like
Yeah.
this wonderful planet that we live
Yeah.
on. Going to space is not in the cards right now. We need to save this planet.
And it's a good read. It's aimed at young adults. It's really, I enjoyed it as an adult. It's a really
Right.
easy read as well.
And that's Green Rising. And then the next one is Finding Bear. And it's a second book, right, from Hannah Gold. That's
Yeah,
a
she did The Last Bear. I like children's stories because when you do children's stories, especially those that can be read aloud, you're getting two for one because you've got the parent reading the story and the child enjoying the story. So you are sowing that kinship with animals and that sense of loss to a certain extent. And she's a beautiful poetic writer, a very simple writer as well. So it's a joy to read. But I also like sort of wanted to, include a children's story because of that two for one angle.
Yeah, we're reading Yucky Worms right now because I have a worm farm in the
Lovely.
basement,
Oh, really?
and my
I had one in my
grandson is
kitchen.
he's 7 years old. He loves worms now because of me, thank God. But so we're reading all about worms, and he's become a worm expert.
Lovely.
Yeah, it's nice. Yeah, I
A
love it.
little tip for you. Do you know that in England, in Somerset, there's an annual worm charming festival?
No,
Yep.
that's funny. So we talked about No More Fairy Tales a little bit, but you want to just flesh it out just a little more to finish off the list?
Yes, so that is, we've got all kinds of really good writers contributed there. We've got 24 short stories, and we've got whodunits, we've got thrillers, family dramas, romances, speculative fiction, all kinds of genres. But all of them, in some way or another, have a climate solution at their heart. And we teamed up climate experts with experienced writers, and sort of through this iterative process, we put together that anthology. And we also link it to a web page. So you might have read a story on something and think, well, how can I make that happen? Then you can go to the website and you can see where the solution is at now, what you can do to progress it, and so on.
Wow, all good stuff. Well, I'm going to add one to the list. I had my guest Ray Naylor on here, and I don't know if you've ever read it, but The Mountain in the Sea is an amazing book. It's a near future thriller, a meditation on the nature of consciousness and an ecological call to arms. And
sounds good.
Oh, it's very good. And it's about a colony of octopus that they find that's sentient, and and it goes on from there, and it's all kinds of political and corporate intrigue. And I think it's one of the better environmental books. So I'm happy to turn you on to it if you don't know about it. And also my listeners who are all going to want to read some of these books that you're recommending.
I will definitely check that out.
Yeah, The Mountain in the Sea, Ray Naylor. Thank you so much for coming today. My guest has been a professor of sustainable business and author of the book, The Habitat Man, Denise Baden. Before I let you go, Ms. Baden, when people learn of these ideas that you're putting out there, what's the most important thing you want them to take away? What should they be doing in their own lives that can be helped by some of the things that you're talking about?
I think joining the dots between what you do and the impact on the environment. Avoiding mindless waste. I think a lot of what we do that's harmful is not intentional. We've been trained by 100 years of consumerism to use more than we need and to not think about what happens to it afterwards. So I think just being more mindful and seeing things from nature's perspective, and also try and find ways to engage other people that perhaps are less catastrophic and more enabling, more like this is what we can do. So simply in our food choices, and I'm a great fan of buying secondhand, not just because it's cheaper, but I find in terms of fashion, I get better selection from our charity shops. And I also worry about all the new chemicals they spray on everything new, if it's waterproofing or if it's fireproofed. All these chemicals, you know, are fairly toxic, actually, and they're all okay in the, they've all been tested and then such small amounts, but we live in a world where almost everything new has them on them. So I actually now think less chemicals is better in my environment. So, and avoiding buying things with a new smell is my new thing that I'm now trying to avoid. So every month I have a new thing. That's this month's thing.
That's good. Yeah, it's one person, one backyard at a time to make change. So I'm with you. So thank you so much, Denise Baden, for being with me today on Digging in the Dirt.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Digging in the Dirt with Kevin Gallagher.